So I began last week talking about the Thatcher governments as the Toryism of the crisis. I don't mean to say that the changes in the Conservative Party were inevitable. They were not inevitable. But they were a response to a long economic crisis, which people were not expecting. Yeah? 1950, the economy is going well. 1955, the economy is going well. 1960, the economy is going well. After 20 years, nobody would say, oh, in 5 years there'll be a crisis. No, people in general, including me, don't understand how the economy works very well. And when the crisis came, it was really quite a surprise. And it meant that inside the Conservative Party, you've always had different currents of thoughts. And in the new situation of the crisis, much more difficult to make profits. Employers, little by little, wanting to be more firm with the trade unions. Well, really wanting somebody else to be firm with them, because it's always risky. And so there was a base for a new approach of a Conservative government, much firmer with the trade unions, really quite aggressive with the trade unions. And this many big employers were happy with this. They didn't want themselves to be aggressive with their trade unions. That's risky. But if the government passes laws to make everything easier, well, that's very good. And so I began last week looking mainly at Margaret Thatcher and the welfare states. The welfare state is important, all that those elements I went through last week, important, but first of all, because it's what the country spends most of its money on. It's about big money, and money, you know, if you're going to spend money on hospitals and government help for childcare and so on, well, somebody has to pay, and so it's also about taxes and so on. I was saying that the Thatcher governments wanted to reduce public spending, or at least stop it rising. It's not easy to reduce public spending when the population are getting older, when there are more and more unemployed people, but at least stop it rising. And in general, persuade people that the ideas of private enterprise were the best ideas. So, today I'm going to move on to Margaret Thatcher and the trade unions, Margaret Thatcher and foreign policy, and the end of Margaret Thatcher. When I say the end, I don't mean that she died. She didn't die, although if you look on the internet, you can see that there are many websites preparing celebrations for when Margaret Thatcher dies. Now, this is politically interesting because I've never seen it happen to any other political leader. Many people, if you're Prime Minister, there are always plenty of people who don't like you. That's not part of the job. But certainly Margaret Thatcher appears to have symbolised something really different. And there are, you know, just have a look at Is Thatcher Dead in Google, and you'll find there are lots of parties organised here. Yeah, so here are big and difficult questions. How did she win three elections if people didn't like her? Well, many reasons for that. One is, of course, on election day, a lot of people stay at home. Yeah, so very high levels of abstention. That is to say that the... why didn't people go to the election? Well, I think that the Labour Party leadership didn't convince people that they could really change things. Yeah, that's the problem, you see. Supposing you don't like the government and it's election time, you will only go to vote for the opposition if you think it will really make a difference. If you think the other party would not be much better, then you'll probably stay at home. If you think that the changes brought in by the government are inevitable anyway, then you'll probably stay at home. So there was a lot of staying at home. And also, there were some ways in which temporarily she managed to mobilise people. In particular, just before the second election, the 1983 one, the Falklands War did manage to mobilise a sort of national sentiment of, the Falkland Islands belong to us. It did have a slightly amusing side, because half of the population didn't know where they were. I didn't know where the Falkland Islands were before the war. on the Falkland Islands. When I spoke to my mother, I remember this very well, because I was living in Spain, which was not the easiest place to live as a British person during the Falklands War. My mother thought the Falklands War was somewhere near Scotland, not somewhere near Argentina. And she's thinking, how did the Argentinians invade the Falkland Islands near Scotland? Yeah. My mother doesn't read the newspapers every day. But, so they were able to mobilize people. And I think also, you know, some of the dynamics about privatization, people thinking, oh, well, maybe it's a good idea. And they may have been disappointed later. So that's one of the things. But there's something else as well, of course, that if you have websites saying, let's have a party when Thatcher dies, that doesn't mean that this is the opinion of the majority. It means it's the opinion of a determined minority who think that they will get enough support for a party, but not necessarily majority. Majorities are complex things. Okay, today I want to have a look at some of the legislation that Margaret Thatcher carried out in connection with the trade unions, and I've given you handouts, so if you can have a look at these. I have some more for people who have eaten them. Has anybody eaten them? Yes, you did. Okay. It always happens. If you don't have them, look at them. Thatcher looked at the problem, or Thatcher, when I say Thatcher, I mean all her governing group. They looked at the problem, how can we make life easier for company owners and more difficult for trade unions? How can we reduce the number of strikes and, in general, change the balance of forces so that employers get more of what they want and trade unions get less of what they want? Why did Margaret Thatcher want to do this? Well, because she believed that the economy would go better if companies were encouraged to invest, were making good profits, etc. The profit was a positive element in the dynamic of the economy. And she probably was one of the most sophisticated governments who looked at this idea of what can a government do in a democratic country to intervene in strikes, which are normally considered to be private matters between an employer and trade unions. And the first thing I mentioned last week is that she went very slowly, do it little by little. The second thing is try to get public opinion with you, because of course the government can to some extent pass a law which is unpopular. But you mustn't pass too many laws which are unpopular, because the next election is only 5 years away. So often be a little careful. Now, you don't need majority opinion for all your laws when you're a government, but you have to play with that. So the very first one that came in is in 1980, the Employment Act 1980. And here you have a slight summary of what was done. Relatively moderate, but some changes which had not happened before. Much more moderate than the Industrial Relations Act 1971, but that exploded. So that's why she didn't want to do that again. For example, there was a limit on social benefits to strikers' families. That is to say that when you're on strike, if you have no money coming in, you could get money from the government, the family could get money from the government, and there is a limit made to that, yes. And so the idea is to make it harder to go on strike, but at the same time in a way which may appear to be reasonable to public opinion. They made it illegal to have secondary strikes. Now, what is a secondary strike? A secondary strike is where you go on strike in support of other workers. So I work in a hospital. I have no problems at the moment with my boss, but next door to the hospital, there are, in the same town, there are the road workers who are on strike, and my union in the hospital says, well, they're right, so we're going to have a 24-hour strike next Tuesday to support the other solidarity strikes. And what the new law did said, if you have a solidarity strike, then you can be sued by the employer for the economic effect of the strike. That is to say that, you know, let's imagine it's a factory and you have a 24-hour strike in support of the nurses. This has existed. Well, after 1980, this is very, very difficult because the factory can say, OK, there was a 24-hour strike. I lost £1 million, which is not impossible, or £100,000. The trade union must pay me this money that I lost. Yeah. Now, in general, the law is that that trade unions cannot be obliged to pay what is lost through strikes, because it's a democratic right to strike. But in the case of secondary strikes after 1980, they are fundamentally illegal or impossible, secondary strikes. They were not necessarily that common, but there were examples. During the 70s, remember when the trade unions were very powerful, there were miners who went on strike to demand more money for the nurses. I think that actually happened in the 1970s. So a very high level, it's not typical, a very high level of trade union solidarity, illegal after 1980. Secondly, the question of pickets, that is the question of if you're on strike, what are you allowed to do? Traditionally, you stand in front of your hospital or factory and you talk to the people coming in, delivering things, say, please don't deliver today, we're on strike. We want you to support us and refuse to deliver. And so there was a limit introduced. Only 6 people were allowed to be on a picket line. The idea being, well, 2 ideas. First of all, to make it a little bit more difficult to picket when there is a high conflict. Because, of course, typically a picket will ask for help from the people delivering. But sometimes you'll just get 100 people there and stop. That make it impossible for the vans to deliver. Not try to persuade them, but try to force them to stop. And that it would now be illegal under the new law. Secondly, it's also a political reason. I mentioned this before. If I pass a law to say that I'm trying to think of an example. If I pass a law to say that people with mobile phones should never be allowed in hospitals. The real reason would simply because I want everybody to think there's a big problem. So some of the laws about pickets were like this. You pass a law, only 6 people are allowed on a picket line. And everybody, the public, say, oh, there must be a big problem with pickets. And that is the objective. The objective is simply to indicate, oh, look at these people. I can think of other examples from French politics, but I'm not giving you a class on French politics. Yeah, that you can pass a big law about a little problem. And the objective is to make everybody think, oh, that's where the problem is. Yeah. If I pass a law against people with blonde hair, then maybe everybody, there must be a terrible problem. The government is passing a law. Oh, yes, terrible problem. Yeah. And this is also part of the thing. Now, the next thing is about strike ballots. That is, how do you decide to go on strike? The government preferred, I think I mentioned this, the government preferred people to vote by post. Do you want to go on strike? You must send a letter. Whereas the trade union prefers to have a big meeting. Okay, give us some reasons for the strike, you. Some reasons against the strike, you. Who wants to go on strike? These are 2 different conceptions of democracy. The trade unionists will say, if we are all together with the people we work with, then if you don't want to strike, you must justify it. And if you want to strike, you must justify it to your workmates. This is democracy. Whereas the government's idea of democracy is, no. If you have everybody together, people could be intimidated. So people should secretly write their answer at home. And the trade unions say, well, that's not fair, because if people write their answer at home, they're in front of the television, and the television hates strikes. They always do. And so we have 2 different conceptions of democracy. Where the trade unions say, well, it's for everybody. And in any case, if we win a 10% rise through a strike, you will accept it, even if you're against the strike. So democracy, we should all be together. And the government say, no, it's individuals who should decide secretly. But notice what they actually did in 1980. Postal ballots before strikes encouraged. They did not have the confidence in 1980 to make postal ballots obligatory. If you go across the line, you can see what happens. 4 years later, secret ballots must be held before industrial action. So you get this idea of secret ballots, and the first law says, oh, we encourage this. And if you organise a secret ballot, we will give you the money you need to organise it. It costs money. And then later it becomes obligatory. So this is good politics, yeah? First of all, you introduce the question to the public debates, and you encourage people, and then later on, because there was no big negative reaction, that it was possible to make it obligatory. So very, very intelligent politics. Same thing a little further on, officer elections. Now, trade union leaders in Britain were elected through 100 different methods, a different one in each union, really. In some unions, they had a national vote where all members voted who should be the leader. In other ones, then the members voted for a regional leader, and the regional leaders voted for a national one. In some trade unions, the president was president for life. There were some good reasons for this, sometimes historical reasons. One of the reasons they used to have union presidents for life was that after you had been union president, you would never get a job again because no employer would employ you. I'm not talking about the 20th century, I'm talking about before. So there were historical reasons for this. And so the governments, again, encourage secret ballots and then will make them obligatory in 1984 more and more. The closed shop, same thing. Perhaps you remember the closed shop, which we call in French the Monopole Syndical à l'Embauche. That is, you can only work in this factory if you're a member of the trade union. That's the closed shop. And this was not unusual. Of course, the trade unions liked it. Of course. Makes your trade union very strong. And also trade unionists would say, well, when we win a wage rise, everybody gets it, so everybody should contribute. Otherwise, it's not fair. Perhaps a little bit more surprisingly, that quite a lot of bosses liked the closed shop because it means you have one trade union to deal with. You're the boss of a factory or a hospital with 1,000 workers, and if everybody's in the same union, it's actually quite practical. You only have to negotiate with one trade union because many bosses consider that trade unions, well, we don't like them, but they will always exist, so you better deal with them the best way you can. And again, here with the closed shop, first of all, the restrictions. And then four years later, then, the closed shop is only possible if 85% of employees vote for it, which is very, very difficult to get 85% of anybody to do anything. Yeah. So these are the changes. So quite complex changes. I'm not going to read them all, and you can go along and see how very, very gradually brought in over 20 years, in fact. No, pas tout à fait. Dans la feuille que vous avez, la toute dernière colonne, c'est le nouveau gouvernement travailliste. Donc ça va dans un autre sens. Pas tout à fait dans le sens contraire, mais ça va tout à fait dans un autre sens. The 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the first six are all conservative laws. Whereas the last one is a labour law. Yeah, so very, very different, very, very different. However, you will notice that the labour law does not abrogate the previous conservative laws. So in fact, what happened, which I will be talking about next week, when Tony Blair came to government, he did not abolish these laws which made life more difficult for unions. Not at all. He did make things easier for unions with this set of laws here, but it was not to eliminate. And in fact, if you look at the manifestos of the Labour Party in 1983, 1987, 1992 and 1997, you can see that at the beginning they promised, we will abrogate all the anti-union laws. And then 5 years later, they say, we will look again at the anti-union laws. Not abrogate, but look again. And then by 1997, they're saying, most of the changes made for trade unions will continue. Yeah, that is, we accept the conservative laws against trade unions. So we have an interesting parallel here. If we go right back to 1945, 1950, where you've got the conservative government of 1951 who come to power and do not change the free hospitals, do not change the nationalisation. In fact, in some areas continue to nationalise, because the whole atmosphere of what appears to be popular is the welfare state, and they can't go against it. And if you come right back to 1997, you get this: the Labourism of the crisis follows some of what the conservatism of the crisis is doing. Okay, I'm not going to go through all of these. Have a look at them. I will come back to them when I'm talking about Tony. When I'm talking about Tony Blair, I will come back to them when I'm talking about Tony Blair. Now, the laws about trade unions were not the only parts of the intervention of the government intervention concerning trade union power. There was another part. And if the Thatcher governments wanted to encourage employers to be firmer on trade unions, of course, it was necessary for the government themselves to be much firmer on trade unions in the public sector. Public sector has been getting bigger and bigger through the 50s, the 60s. Yeah, free hospitals means a lot more public workers. Nationalised railways, road building, house building, a lot of... So the public sector is, even today, is huge. I don't have figures to mind on how many people work in the public sector, but I think it's about 30% of workers. It's enormous. And so, whereas in the 50s and 60s, the government was particularly favourable to trade unions in the public sector because they wanted to encourage private employers to be... moderate and reasonable in negotiations. This changed with the Thatcher governments, and they wanted to show the example to private employers of how to be firm. And they did this in a number of ways. In general, it was more difficult to be a trade unionist in the public sector in the 80s than in the 70s. They reduced the amount of hours which a union representative can spend on union business. What we call en français heure de délégation, and in English facility time. In 100 ways, they made things more difficult. And there were two important big battles. One was GCHQ. And one was the miners' strike. The first one was a defeat for the Conservative government, and the second one was an important victory. So what was GCHQ? Again, it was a symbolic beginning. What the government did is that they declared that in the General Communications Headquarters, which was a military office, a military communications centre. There you go. Yeah, General Communications Headquarters. This is a military centre, but which has a lot of civilian employees. And they said, from now on, it is illegal to have trade unions in this communications centre. Illegal to have trade unions in this communications centre. Now, of course, traditionally in the army, trade unions are banned. But this was not the army. This was a civilian office workers in the communications headquarters. So why did they do this? It's a small number of people, a few hundred people. Well, the aim was, first of all, to tell the entire population, trade unions are a terrible problem. We don't want them in our military in our military centres. They might be subversives or spies or something. And secondly, it was the beginning. If you could accept the principle that the government can decide to ban trade unions in this, well, then they could perhaps ban trade unions in the police force, in the firefighters and so on. You know, it was a beginning. It was to introduce the principle that the government can ban trade unions in certain parts of the economy. Because, of course, they could not dream of banning trade unions everywhere. That's impossible without having a military coup d'etat, which is tiring. But they wanted to be able to extend an area of government work where there were no trade unions. this turned out to be very difficult because the trade unions, to everybody's surprise, made a very energetic response. Many strikes were organised to protest, not just inside GCHQ, but national strikes, 24-hour strikes, to protest against this. I remember at one point there are, well, I think 100,000 people on strike to defend the, I think, 50 people or something like that who refused to leave the trade union. A very small number of people refused to leave the trade union, and they were given a year to think about it, and then they were sacked. They lost their jobs because they determined to stay in the trade unions. This caused a large number of strikes, and when the Conservative government went and the new Labour government came, this was reversed. And today, if you work at GCHQ, you can be a member of a trade union like anywhere else. Now, the GCHQ was a small number of people, but let's say that the Conservative government did not succeed in establishing the principle that you can ban trade unions in this place or that place if you think it's vulnerable. Because the reaction of the trade unions in general was much stronger than they thought it would be. And the small number of trade unions who were sacked became heroes, in fact, and went around the country giving big meetings. And so politically, it was a failure. The miners' strike, however, was quite a different cup of tea and was probably the most important victory of Margaret Thatcher in the question of the trade unions. Now, I'm talking a lot about trade unions, but it's because even today in Britain there are 7 million trade unionists. When Margaret Thatcher came to power first in 1979, there were 12 million trade unionists. So trade union activity plays a big role in deciding where does the money go, how much of it goes to improving people's wages and working conditions, and how much of it goes to other priorities, including company profits. It can feel a little bit like bureaucratic detail what happened to the trade unions, but it does make quite a difference to how society is organised. So let's look at the miners' strike now. The miners, I have already mentioned, were the strongest trade union in the history of Britain. Tell me if I'm repeating myself, but during the strike, I was in a village in Yorkshire, a mining village, and somebody said to me, "Do you see that man over there?" He said, "If he goes into the local shops, people refuse to serve him." I say, "Why?" "It's because he refused to go on strike in 1926. That was the atmosphere in the miners' villages. If somebody refused to go on strike, the people in the village would not talk to them ever again in their lives. The reason for this is partly because the mining villages, everybody lived together, lived in the same village and worked in the same mine, firstly. And secondly, mining is a matter of life and death. Many people die in mining, and if you have strong unions, not so many people die. The up and down of it, yeah. So they'd learnt trade unionism in an atmosphere where it was a matter of life and death. And so they were the strongest, and certainly in the case of a picket line, if anybody was on strike, no miner would ever cross a picket line. Je vous ai raconté le petite anecdote du film Les Virtuoses. Non? Ok, je vais vous raconter déjà en français. It's a film about miners, and in a pub, one of the miners is unhappy about what one of the others has done, who's too friendly with the manager, and he says, "You're just a scab. Vous n'êtes qu'un jeune." Okay, and which is the worst possible insult. I can't remember it in English, but in the French version, the man gets up and says, "Redis ça un peu pour voir." And the other man says, vous n'êtes qu'un jeune. "Vous retirez ça, sinon je vous casse la gueule." He says, "Ouais, d'accord, vous n'êtes pas un jeune. Vous n'êtes qu'un enculé." He says, "Bon, ça va mieux." Okay. Okay. It's not a joke that scab was worse than the worst possible insult. Scab was even worse, yeah? And that's, I mean, of course, it's just a film, but you could really feel that. I was in the miners' strike. I was working in the kitchen because they were on strike for a year, and so they had no food. And so we organised kitchens to make food for them. And one day, one of the young and stupid miners stole some money from the money we had collected, and he had to leave the region. He had to go and live 200 miles away. Otherwise, he was in real danger. It was a very, very strong atmosphere. So what was happening? Well, Margaret Thatcher prepared the strike very carefully. In 1981, there was a conflict with the miners, but there was no strike because Margaret Thatcher immediately made concessions in 1981. She was preparing for the big conflict. And how do you prepare for a coal strike when you're at the government? Well, you collect coal. You make sure there's big stock, very very strong, very big stocks of coal. On the other side, the leader of the miners was Arthur Scargill. Yeah, Arthur Scargill, who was, for the miners, was really a hero. When there were the demonstrations during the miners' strike, they used to sing, "Arthur Scargill walks on water, la 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 la." And you wondered, was it a joke? And it was not really quite a joke. Yeah. Certainly, if you wanted to say anything negative about Arthur Scargill, you had to be a big, strong man, yeah? And even so, it was a very big thing. So what happened is the government announced in March 1984, the government announced, here is a list of mines we are going to close. We are going to close all these mines. Why March? It's the beginning of spring. Yes. Nobody needs coal, yeah. Nobody needs coal in April, May, June, July, August. They need coal in November, December, heating, yeah. So careful timing, big stocks. On the other hand, the Arthur Scargill and the miners believed that even though it's not a good time for a strike, we have no choice because this is a long list of mines they want to close. And so the strike was started in a traditional way. That is that miners went from one mine, they voted the strike, and then they said, okay, yeah, you go to this mine, and go and picket them and explain to them, no, you must come on strike as well. And in 3 days, 80% of the miners in the country were on strike. So they did not have a ballot. Ils n'ont pas fait voter individuellement tous les mineurs avant de décider la grève. They did it a traditional, more spontaneous way. And this was politically, this was probably inevitable, but it was politically a problem because all of the newspapers said, Arthur Scargill is not democratic. The strike went on week after week. It lasted a year altogether. The miners I knew sold their houses. Les mineurs que je connaissais, ils ont vendu leur maison. Qu'est-ce que vous faites? Vous n'avez pas de salaire pendant un an. So very, very hard, very, very determined. A few people died on the strike. I'm about to say. Firstly, some pickets. You see, what you have is you have the strikers and then a small number of miners who wanted to continue working. And on two occasions, they came into work by car and killed some pickets, yeah, for example. In another case, the pickets wanted to stop a working miner. These are young miners, and they took a big piece of rock and they dropped it off a bridge onto the taxi of the working miner, and the taxi driver was killed. It's a very, very heavy situation. On the other hand, I think during the miners' strike, 6 people were killed, whereas on average, if you work in a normal year, 12 people are killed in the mines. So it was safer. It was safer to be on strike than to go to work. But the atmosphere was very, very tense. The police were organised in thousands to defend. So what would typically would happen is you'd have a in some of the mines, miners continued to work, and the strikers came to try to stop them, and so you had 200 working miners, 5,000 policemen, and 3,000 striking miners. Fights, yeah. Every week for months and months and months. It's quite complicated because there's a lot of different things you can do in a strike. So I won't go into all the details. But there were two moments when one of the difficulties. Yes? Yes, that's an important question, the difference between trade unions in France and in Britain. Fundamentally, no. That is to say that there is one confederation in Britain, the Trade Union Congress. Whereas in France you have the CGT, the CFDT, FO, which is offered, it is normally a political division between the CGT and the CFDT. It's a different kind of politics. Whereas in Britain, for the miners there is one union. For the railway workers there is one union. And there's just one confederation. There's just one. Which can be an advantage, because it cuts down divisions, yeah? And it makes it easier to get people to join a union, because there's just one. You don't have to say, join our union, it's better than the other one. That's not necessary. You just say, join the National Union of Teachers, because it's the National Union of Teachers. Yeah. And you're a teacher. It just makes things simpler sometimes, Whereas it, and it also means you get a lot of people in the trade unions in Britain who are not interested in politics. Whereas in France, it's not easy to be active in a union if you're not interested in politics, because it's very political. Good question. There were two because Margaret Thatcher won, does not mean it was inevitable. This is what you always have to be careful with history. What happened was not inevitable just because it happened. There were two moments when Margaret Thatcher could have lost. First of all, there was Orgreave. I will try to put a video on the blog about Orgreave. Orgreave is a steelworks in Assyrie, and there was a very big battle in front of Orgreave to try to stop it from working, to make the strike more effective. And secondly, it's a steelworks, an acierie. It's a factory which makes steel. And it was a very important place. Maintenant, vous vous faites douter. Est-ce que ce n'est pas une usine de transformation du charbon? I think that's more likely. It's probably a coke works, yes. And it was one of the big battles. And the other was another trade union. The National Union of Miners was on strike, and NECODS is the organization of, en fait, c'est le syndicat des contremaîtres. They were not on strike. Now, from one point of view, this is not a big problem. The foremen can't get coal without the miners. They can't replace the miners. But at one point, they threatened to go on strike. NECODS, in November, I think, they said, we will join the strike. And this was a big problem for the government because, from a technical point of view, if you have a mine which you are not using, there are no miners, you still need some people to keep the water out, to make things safe, and so on. It's very important to have a small number of people working in the mine to keep it safe. And so if NECODS had joined the strike, then that would have been a major problem for the government and they could easily have lost. At the last moment, NECODS, the trade union of the supervisors in the mine, decided not to join the strike. So those were the two moments. And finally, after a year, the thing finished. Something else happened which was interesting. The government appealed to the wives of the miners. Said, oh, listen, we know that the miners' wives understand how terrible it is for your family. Please tell your husbands to stop the strike. Tell your boyfriends to stop the strike. And this was a complete failure. In fact, the women organized women's groups, Women Against Pit Closures, Les Femmes Contre la Fermeture des Mines, and they became a big national movement of women. In fact, international. They went traveling around France and Russia and Germany getting support. So very 1980s, very modern, The miners' wives were really at the front of the strike, a very new idea. Also, other similar things happened. There was a group called Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners. And at the beginning of the strike, they came along to the miners' demonstration and said, "We are Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners." And the miners were like, "What? Yeah." Because, of course, a very traditional culture in the minings. But before at the end of the strike, they were completely integrated, and the last big demonstration of the strike at the front was a pink bus with Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners. So people's ideas change. Just one more example on that. I was in Leeds during the miners' strike, and every Saturday morning in front of the supermarket, we used to get a bucket, "Support the miners, give us money for the miners to pay for the food for the kitchens." Every Saturday we did this. And the part of town where I was half and half black people and white people, very mixed town. Of course, the miners were all white because they lived in villages and they'd been miners forever. And there was a miner with me collecting money, and he noticed that black people gave more money because they knew problems with the police. They understand this. And afterwards, the miner said to me, he said, "Listen, John," he said, "I have always been a racist. But if anybody says anything against black people, I'll kill them." So I think the racists in his village had a bad time after that. It's very interesting how people's ideas change when suddenly their life changes. It came to an end. It was impossible to continue. After 1 year, the miners went back to work. In one of the pits, I remember seeing the wives and the girlfriends were there, and they gave flowers. They gave carnations to the flower of the hero to the miners who were coming back to work. Now, from an economic point of view, it was a disaster. Margaret Thatcher won by importing coal from Poland and by paying the police millions of pounds to protect the few working miners. Economically, it was a disaster for the government. It cost them millions of pounds. Politically, it was a major victory for Margaret Thatcher. All the trade unions, not just the miners, all the trade unions were demoralised for 15 years. In 1987, 1988, 1990, 1995, if you were a nurse or a teacher or a factory worker, at the moment when you said, "Well, we need a strike," somebody said, "The miners lost. What can we do if the miners lost?" You got a massive demoralisation. This was the objective, and it was a major victory for Margaret Thatcher. Okay, I'll stop there on the trade unions. What else is happening politically at this time? Well, two or three other elements. In connection with foreign policy, first of all, I already told you about the campaign for a nuclear disarmament in 1958, 1959, 1960. Well, there was a new wave, another wave of demonstrations and petitions and meetings and films and a massive campaign in 1980. 1981, 1982. At the beginning of the 1980s, it was a big movement. I come from a small town. I went there this weekend to see my mother, a small town called Hindburn. And there are 20,000 members. 20,000 people live there. Maybe 30,000 people live there. In 1981, they had 1,000 members to the campaign for nuclear disarmament. Yeah, 1,000 members in a small town, a small provincial town of 30,000 people. That really is a mass movement, and not a very political town. A very, very sleepy town. In fact, the town that I come from is so sleepy that when you open the newspaper, it's incredible. You open the local newspaper, and this is not a joke. And I opened the newspaper, and it said, "Last Friday, a policeman was walking down such and such a road, and he saw that a wing mirror had been broken off a car. That's the end of the story. That was in the newspaper. Yeah, it was really a policeman. Un policier avait trouvé qu'un rétroviseur avait été cassé par un délinquant dans la rue. Et ça passe dans le journal local. That's how sleepy this town is. Nothing happens, you know. So I thought that was amusing. Okay, so CND, very important. Why at this moment? Well, people were very worried about nuclear war. America and Russia had very bad relations. The president of America at this time. Yeah. 1980, the election of, oh, that's 1974, 6 years out. Ronald Reagan, yeah. And Ronald Reagan was frightening. Yeah, I remember there's a moment he was on the radio, and he thought that the microphone, he thought that he was testing the microphone, and he thought nobody could hear, and he said, "We're going to bomb Moscow in 10 minutes." He said this as a joke. He thought it was funny. Okay, this is Ronald Reagan was scary. So that was one reason. And in particular, the United States had decided they wanted to base a new kind of missile, cruise missile, say missile croisière. The British government had agreed to allow the United States to site a new kind of nuclear weapon, for cruise missiles, in Britain, which could be used for attacking Eastern Europe and places like that. The result of this was massive demonstrations, up to 250,000 people. Yeah, the cruise missiles are a new kind of nuclear weapon. The British government said, okay, you could put your new American nuclear missiles in Britain. You can place them here, no problem. And this caused a massive campaign against this. Demonstrations, and this is 1981, 1982. Donc, je n'ai pas tout à fait dans l'ordre chronologique parce que la grève des mineurs, c'est de 84. Mostly a traditional sort of campaign, petitions, demonstrations, theatre, films, meetings, etc. But there were some new ideas, and in particular at Greenham Common. Greenham Common was an American base, an American military base in Britain. Have you heard of Greenham Common? Okay. And there were a group of women who were against nuclear weapons, and they organized a peace camp. They organized a permanent camp just next to the military base, and they lived there for a couple of years, a kind of permanent demonstration. Generally a feminist take. Most of the camps were only for women. It was a sort of feminist pacifist take. One of the slogans they used was take the toys from the boys. Yeah, the toys, the nuclear weapons, take them away from the boys, the soldiers. So a lot of the ideas of the camp at Greenham Common were radical feminist ideas, the idea that the reason for war is the defects of masculine ways of doing things. And so women have the solution to war because men organize wars, so you need women to stop them. Kind of traditional idea. But really quite, they organized a demonstration where they had women all the way around the missile base singing. It was kind of intimidating for the soldiers. And sometimes they broke into the military base as well. So lots of symbolic but non-violent campaigning by the people at Greenham Common. Let's move on to the Falklands then. The Falklands, in a way, they are islands near Argentina, part of the British Empire. almost by accident, because there was a time when Britain just went and collected islands anywhere. From a military point of view, quite an interesting place to have an island, a useful place, yes? Oh, sorry, you're just waving your arms about. Okay. I'm trying to think how many people lived there. I have the numbers here, how many people lived there. I think it's 2,000 or 3,000 people, something like that. A few thousand people lived there. And the Argentinian government said these islands belong to Argentina because it's not very far. And they had a traditional claim on them. Because of internal political problems, the Argentinian government invaded the islands in 1982. It was probably... Nobody was killed. Nobody was killed at that point on the invasion of the island. Nobody was killed. But then the Argentinians put 10,000 soldiers on the islands. And from a political point of view, this was very successful. The government in Argentina suddenly became much more popular because they had humiliated Great Britain in the name of little Argentina. Yeah? Of course, Argentina is big, but much poorer. Was it possible to negotiate a solution? Perhaps, but in any case, the Margaret Thatcher's government decided to send the Navy. It takes a long time to get there. It's weeks and weeks to get there. Carried out a... It's 13,000 kilometres away from Britain. 13,000. 13,000 kilometres. So they sent the Navy with modern weapons. Now, there was no doubt about who was going to win. The British Army is much, much more sophisticated and expensive than the Argentinian. There was no competition. Also, the British had help from the United States, intelligence help, not military help, and also help from the Chilean regime under General Pinochet. So, of course, they were victorious. 250 British soldiers were killed, and 750 Argentinian soldiers were killed. So it's what you, in a way, it's a small war, but it's symbolically very important. There was one particular moment which was considered to be symbolic, and this was the moment of the Belgrano. The Belgrano was an Argentinian ship, with 400 people on it. And Margaret Thatcher personally ordered the sinking of this ship, although it was not attacking. So this was a controversial decision where Margaret Thatcher personally said, yes, sink that ship, and all the people on it were killed. However, this was carried out at a moment when the ship was not attacking, was not going towards the Falklands, was just there. Yeah, and so it was a controversial attack. So it was not difficult for the British to win the war. Yes? A cruiser. Un croiseur. I have to say that I don't know a lot about. It's a military ship. But it was not. Attacking. They didn't. I don't know a lot about the rules of military engagement. But it was controversial. That I do know. From a political point of view. For Thatcher, it was very successful. It has to be said that during this short war, the British press launched a big campaign against the Argentinians. The Sun, the famous newspaper The Sun, organised a competition for the best racist jokes against Argentinians. It's got style. It's got style. Well, it was not subtle. So that was the up and down of it. It was important in the history of British politics because 1982 was the Falklands War. 1983 was the general election. Before the Falklands War, Thatcher's government was not looking very strong. Will they win the next general election? Difficult to say. After the Falklands War, Thatcher won the election easily. So this is one of the things that your politics is a very complicated business, and sometimes something happens which was not expected and can really switch things around. Finally, then, the EEC, the European Economic Community. Now, traditionally, the British elite's attitude to Europe has been somewhat ambiguous for good reasons. First of all, the commercial exchanges of Britain are not highly dependent on Europe. Britain can trade with America, can trade with the Commonwealth, Australia, West Africa, English-speaking world, or can trade with Europe. There are three poles. So Europe is important, but it's not the centre. Whereas for France, Europe is really central. So France could never imagine not being part of the Euro, not being part of the European Union. Whereas Britain had more choice. Part of the Conservative Party had always been against a close involvement with Europe. Mrs. Thatcher gave a famous speech, I don't have the date here, in the early 1980s at Bruges. Say again? That's the one, yes. That's the one, yes. I want my money back, yes. So she gave a speech at the European Union to claim that European integration was going too far. Britain was being asked to pay too much. Now, this had two reasons. The main reason was to please the public opinion at home, by showing herself as a sort of de Gaulle anglais, yeah? By showing herself as a determined defender of the interests of the British. This is what she said. It is ironic that just when those countries such as the Soviet Union, which have tried to run everything from the centre, are learning that success depends on dispersing power and decisions away from the centre, some in the community seem to want to move in the opposite direction. So she is comparing those who want a close integration of Europe with the Soviet Union, you know, the communists, the centralizers, horrible people. So a very, very strong political attempt there. Wanting less power for the European Union institutions and more decentralisation. Now, decentralisation, that is to leave the power in Britain and France, etc. Now, of course, one shouldn't take this necessarily at face value. Decentralisation for Margaret Thatcher was a very good idea when it meant more power for Britain and less power for Europe. But, of course, decentralisation inside Britain for Scotland and Wales, she refused completely. Yeah. So she was not generally in favour of decentralisation. Certainly, she her speech was in a tone which is not traditional in diplomatic circles. She was much more aggressive than one would normally be in that kind of situation. So, for example, some of the European Union at this time, so the European Economic Community, so ça s'appelle pas encore European Union, they said, we don't need passports to go from England to France and France to Germany. It's not necessary. And Margaret Thatcher said, oh, yes, we need these passports to protect our citizens and to stop the movements of drugs, terrorists, and illegal immigrants. Old-fashioned view of looking at it. So a very important level there with the EEC. This is not foreign policy really, but it's a little bit like foreign policy, and this is the question of the hunger strike. I spoke to you a couple of weeks ago about Bloody Sunday and this situation in Northern Ireland where they high level of discrimination against Catholics, and that the police almost completely Protestant, and the British Army generally siding with the Protestants. Well, this came to a head with the case of Irish prisoners. These were people who were generally in prison because they were members of an illegal organisation, the Irish Republican Army, the IRA. And before 1980, the IRA prisoners were treated a little bit like prisoners of war or political prisoners. They had what we call political status. That means they were allowed to read newspapers. They were not obliged to wear prison uniform. They were not obliged to do prison work. They could have meetings. There was a special status, partly in response to the fact that they had not had normal trials. There were no juries, etc. Yeah, so it was a political thing. And in 1980, the government decides to end political status. The position of Margaret Thatcher is these are criminals. They are not politicians. They're not prisoners of war. They are just criminals, and they have no support. And so in the prisons, the prisoners were told that they were obliged to wear prison uniform. And the IRA members said, no, we refuse to wear prison uniform because we are not criminals. We are soldiers for Ireland, and we're in prison because that's life. We're prisoners of war. We accept that. But we refuse to wear the uniform of a criminal. And so the prison authorities said, well, if you don't wear prison uniform, you can't have any clothes. And so the prisoners said, okay. And for several years, they wore only a blanket. You know, they were not allowed any clothes because they would refuse to wear prison uniform. It gets worse. Then the prison authorities said, if you don't wear prison uniform, you cannot go to the toilets. And so the prisoners said, well, okay. And so they started a new protest where they couldn't go to the toilet, and they dried the shit on the walls and just generally lived in very, very bad conditions. Il y a un film qui n'est pas si bien que ça qui s'appelle Hunger. Au sujet de cette grève de la faim. C'est pas si bien que ça. N'empêche qu'on apprend des choses. And the third and final tactic of the prisoners was the hunger strike. Now, obviously, a hunger strike is not something you do if you have many other possibilities, because it's very, very dangerous. Indeed, the strike lasted 66 days, and 10 people died. 10 of the prisoners died. The most famous one. Who's the most famous of the hunger strikers? Thank you. Yes, Bobby Sands, yeah. Il y a rue Bobby Sands, Saint-Denis. Bobby Sands is the most famous one. C'est un peu dommage pour le deuxième à mourir. Tout le monde a oublié le deuxième qui est mort. Le premier, c'est lui. C'est pas très juste. And this was a very interesting case because the government said... The Margaret Thatcher's government said they are criminals, they are murderers, they are not politicians, they're not soldiers, and they have no support. And Bobby Sands and a few others were on hunger strike. Ils avaient commencé de façon décalée un nouveau gréviste à la fin tous les 10 jours pour des raisons politiques. At this moment, accidentally, one of the members of parliament for Northern Ireland died for another reason. And so there was an election, a by-election. Il y avait une élection partielle. And, vous devinez la suite, Bobby Sands was elected Member of Parliament while he was on hunger strike in prison. So this was a political victory for Bobby Sands, because Margaret Thatcher was saying, these people are criminals who have no support. And there was an election. He was elected Member of Parliament. He couldn't go to London, but yes, in London. For Westminster, a Member of Parliament, who would normally sit in Westminster representing somewhere in Northern Ireland, a town in Northern Ireland. Of course, he couldn't go there, one, because he was in prison, and two, because he died shortly afterwards. But yeah, the symbol was very big. Now, after 10 prisoners had died, the families of the remaining prisoners persuaded them to stop the hunger strike. So, from an immediate point of view, it was a defeat for the hunger strikers. They did not immediately get their objectives, which were no prison work, no prison uniforms, etc. On the other hand, from a political point of view, it was a great victory. In every newspaper in the world said, you know, the British government killed a Member of Parliament by refusing to negotiate. So politically, it was a great victory. Like I say, Margaret Thatcher said, they have no support, and then he is elected Member of Parliament. The British government looked very, very bad. And indeed, in other ways, the British government has been made to look very bad. The European Court of Human Rights condemned Britain in the early 1990s for torture, for the use of torture in Northern Ireland. So, you know, it's not a pretty story, all of that. And even today, in Ireland, Bobby Sands is a hero and martyr. So, which just leaves me with one last thing for today, and then we're going to move on to our star for the afternoon. And this is the end of Thatcher. Now, Margaret Thatcher will resign in 1990. So after 11 years, she will be replaced by John Major, who will successfully win another election and remain in office until 1997. So by the time New Labour get another chance in office, we have had 18 years of Conservative government, which is a lot of time. Now, John Major had generally the same ideas as Margaret Thatcher, but he was much less. He carried out far fewer reforms because his government was not as strong, and so he continued Thatcherism, but much slower. Why did Thatcher resign? And how does it work? It's interesting because it tells us some things about how politics works. Because I remember that the day before Margaret Thatcher resigned, she was in Paris. And somebody interviewed her and says, would you think of resigning? What do you think she said? I will never resign. One day later, she resigned. Now, this is normal, because if you are a prime minister in a difficult situation, you cannot say on television, I might resign or I might not. This is political suicide. You can't say, I might resign. I will never resign until the moment when you resign. Because you know, that's the only way you can strengthen your side and demoralise the others. It shows that... the immediate reason for her resignation was a disagreement in the Conservative Party over Europe. Everybody has forgotten what the disagreement was. It wasn't very important. And the suggestion that somebody was going to stand against her. Il y avait une élection pour le dirigeant du Parti conservateur. Et si tout était allé bien, elle n'aurait pas eu de candidat en face. Et là, il y a quelqu'un qui dit, non, non, moi, je vais présenter contre elle. So that was the immediate reason. But the fundamental reason is that she had lost a lot of popularity, and the Conservative Party leaders say, if we keep Margaret Thatcher, we will lose. So how did she lose a lot of popularity? Well, the most important element is the poll tax. And this is the last thing I will be explaining today. It's a tax. The community charge is the official name of this tax, and the poll tax is the name which the opponents used. What does it mean? Well, one of the problems that the government, that the Conservative government had, is that they controlled, of course, the national government, no problem, but the local governments, les municipalités, they could do what they like. A lot of them were controlled by Labour, a lot of them were very left-wing, and did what they could to raise money in local taxes and spend money on housing or roads and so on in a traditional sort of way. And so Margaret Thatcher says, how can we stop the local councils from taking too much tax from the rich and spending too much on public services? Well, she said, we're going to change the system of local taxes. The traditional system of local taxes, the rates, is like in France. If you have a big house, you pay a lot. If you have a little house, you don't pay very much. It's about how big is your house, or what is the value of your house. And Margaret Thatcher says, no, we're going to have a new system. And in the new system, every adult in the town will pay the same cost. Now, this is a very audacious reform. No country in the world does this. This doesn't exist. It's generally considered in democratic countries that rich people should pay more tax. That's the general consensus. And so Margaret Thatcher was going against this and said, okay, you live in a very small house, that's £200, please. You live in a chateau, that's £200, please. The same for every adult. So a new principle of collecting local taxes. Of course, you say, of course there will be help for people who do not have enough money. Yeah? So something. So this was the idea, and fundamentally, this was a little bit like this was like Napoleon saying, maybe I could invade Moscow. Yeah. If you're tempted to invade Moscow, don't. It's too cold. It's dangerous. Yeah. And this was Margaret Thatcher's Moscow. She went too far. Why? Was it psychological? Was she overconfident? We don't know exactly. But she went to do something like this. It was not possible. 5 million people refused to pay. Now, if 500 people refuse to pay, you put them in prison. If 5,000 people refuse to pay, you make them pay a fine or something. You use the police. What do you do when 5 million people refuse to pay? It's unworkable. It's impossible. And this was the moment when I realized that Thatcher was dead politically. My parents are very conservative people. My father always voted for Margaret Thatcher. And one Christmas in 1990, I went home, and my dad said, I think I'm going to refuse to pay the poll tax. And I thought, Margaret Thatcher is dead. If my father, the most conservative man in the history of mankind, is thinking of refusing to pay the poll tax, she is dead. Which was true. No, he did pay it, okay. But he was thinking about it. And that was pretty incredible. There were demonstrations in March 1990. There were demonstrations. 200,000 demonstrators in Trafalgar Square. Big fights with the police. Buildings set on fire. 400 people injured. 300 people arrested. A traditional way of persuading the government to do things differently: rioting. And the funny thing was that you had this riot and people burning buildings and so on, and most of the population appeared to think, well, it's not very... They're probably right. You had the most popular riots we've had for... Because normally when you have riots, most people are saying, oh, no, I don't want there to be riots. But these were incredibly popular riots because it appeared that there was no... After 11 years of Conservative government, it appeared that there was no alternative. And this was the situation in March 1990. Margaret Thatcher resigned on another question a few months later, but I don't think it was really on another question. And John Major, the new Conservative Prime Minister, will bury the poll tax. We'll forget the idea. It was a bad idea. I think it was never going to work. It would be very, very... I mean, this was more radical Conservative than Ronald Reagan or George Bush. That was really very well out there. OK, so thank you for listening. And it's time for us to listen to somebody else for a change. I'm sure you will be fine.